From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It turns out the so-called successful test of missile defense had a little help, a beacon in the warhead of the enemy missile. We'll talk with a leading critic of missile defense, the MIT physicist who says the Pentagon is trying to silence him. And on this 56th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, we'll hear from a survivor.
I was really 12 years old then, in my first year of girls' junior high school. A strong flash pierced my eyes.
And a Native American woman whose mother died of cancer after working in the uranium mines of New Mexico. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Palestinian opened fire on soldiers in front of the Defense Ministry on a busy Tel Aviv street yesterday, injuring 10 people in the first mass shooting in an Israeli city since the fighting began last September. The gunman died after being hit by return fire. Hours later, Israeli helicopters fired missiles in the West Bank town of Tulkarem, killing a 23-year-old Hamas activist, Amer Mansour Habiri. The car in which he was traveling was also destroyed. Israel's army claimed Habiri was named as a senior terrorist during the interrogations of Hamas activists in the area. Israel said he was responsible for multiple bombings and shootings and was organizing suicide attacks that were to take place within days. Israel has come under international criticism for its targeted killings of suspected Palestinian militants. But Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says the policy will remain in place unless Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat reins in the militants. The Israeli Defense Ministry has published a list of what it called the seven main terrorists whose arrest it has demanded from the Palestinian Authority. Japan today marked the 56th anniversary of the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima in World War II. Roughly 50,000 people gathered for the ceremony in the Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima, about 438 miles southwest of Tokyo. The Hiroshima city government puts the total number of people who've died after being exposed to radiation from the bombing at some 220,000, including nearly 5,000 people who died in the past year. Meanwhile, in London, nuclear disarmament campaigners today mark the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing with a rally protesting the controversial U.S. Son of Star Wars project, as they call it. Labour MP Jeremy Corbyn described President Bush's promotion of the scheme as a, quote, monumental folly of the highest order. He said the sinister development would mean there was a real possibility that the horrors of Hiroshima could revisit the world at some point in the future. He said, quote, as Bush goes ahead with his crazy plans, Hiroshima stands out starkly as a warning to the world about the implications of nuclear war. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, this weekend repeated a promise to suspend ballistic missile launchings until the year 2003, saying in a declaration with President Vladimir Putin in Moscow that his nation's missile program does not present a threat to nations respecting North Korea's sovereignty. The declaration aims squarely at the United States' proposal to build a defense against ballistic missile attacks by so-called rogue states, came at a Kremlin meeting of the two leaders. The United States has repeatedly cited a threat from North Korea as part of its rationale for wanting to build a shield, which Russia opposes for fear it would challenge its own arsenal and scuttle an important arms control agreement with the United States. North Korea first pledged to suspend missile launches in 1999 during an effort by President Clinton's White House to curb missile and nuclear programs that had threatened to escalate into a military crisis on the Korean Peninsula. The statement today was the second iteration of that guarantee and the first such overture to President Bush. Former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader, proclaiming he was creating a new kind of civic festival that would sweep the country, attracted about 7,000 people on Saturday to an evening of political activism at the Rose Garden in Portland, Oregon. Just as his Portland event a year ago launched his campaign on a series of super rallies around the country, Nader said the success of his Rose Garden appearance would spark more in other cities. The rally capped a day of workshops and lectures designed to channel people into a series of grassroots causes. claiming that an arm of Congress was seeking to, quote, unconstitutionally interfere with the workings of the White House. Vice President Dick Cheney on Friday formally refused to turn over documents demanded as part of a congressional investigation of the administration's energy plan. The decision to contest the inquiry by the General Accounting Office makes it likely that the Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, will take the White House to court to enforce its demand for documents, which it says it has the authority to review. In April, the office, which is nonpartisan, began requesting documents that detail how the administration assembled its energy plan, which Democrats assert was intended to benefit oil, coal, gas companies, and other big contributors to the Bush presidential campaign. Numerous corporate chief executives have said they met with Cheney and White House staff in the spring when the energy blueprint was being prepared. Environmentalists and consumer advocates said they were not invited to the White House to discuss energy issues until after the report was written in May. Sashi Oiwaki, sung by a fisherman from the Alan Lomax Collection sampler, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 56 years ago today, at 8:15 a.m. Japan time, the U.S. B-29 bomber Enola Gay dropped a 4-ton uranium atomic bomb on Hiroshima. It was codenamed Little Boy. Soon afterwards, as reporters converged on a ship off the coast of Japan to cover the surrender of the Japanese in World War II, one independent reporter named Wilfred Burchett took a train for 30 hours to Hiroshima. He couldn't believe what he saw, people with their skin melting off them, images of people engraved on the sides of buildings. He sat down with his Hermes typewriter in the rubble and tapped out the words, "I write this as a warning to the world." He talked about something he called bomb sickness that he had never seen before. Another reporter did a 10-part series on the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He was William Leonard Lawrence of the New York Times. He was also on the payroll of the Pentagon. Lawrence wrote the series of articles on the bomb and its effect, and one of his headlines was, "No Bomb Sickness Found." He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. Wilfred Burchett died of cancer decades later, always traced it back to Hiroshima. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we're going to speak with a survivor of the bombing of Hiroshima, as well as to a Native American woman whose mother was killed by cancer caused by uranium mining in her community in New Mexico. But first, we'll discuss the latest weapons system of the United States. In 1945, President Harry Truman tried to frame the atom bomb as a defensive weapon, saying it would bring the war to a swift end and ultimately save lives. In 2001, the Pentagon is calling its latest weapon National Missile Defense, claiming it'll protect the United States from attack by rogue states. The U.S. atomic bomb attack ushered in the most deadly and protracted arms race the modern world has seen. National Missile Defense threatens to do the same. According to several Pentagon reports, and as the New York Times Magazine yesterday reported in a 10-page expose, National Missile Defense is only one branch of a grand scheme for the total U.S. military domination of space. A nuclear arms race, a race to militarize space, an estimated $95 million already spent on NMD, all this for a system that, according to many critics, doesn't work. We're joined now by Theodore Postol. He's a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT, and he's accusing the Pentagon of trying to silence him and intimidate his employer, MIT, for his criticism of national missile defense. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Postol.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, can you start off by explaining what national missile defense is and why don't you believe it works?
Well, basically, national missile defense is a system, or in fact a set of systems now, that are supposed to intercept warheads that are launched by ballistic missiles at long range. And a typical warhead might look, might be 6 or 8 feet in length and about 3 to 5 feet on the base. It would look cone-like. And these objects travel most of the time through the near vacuum of space and at very high speeds. So a speed would be about 4.5 to 5 miles per second. The main feature, the main component of the national missile defense is a system called, basically what's called a mid-course system, which is supposed to intercept warheads in the near vacuum of space. And this near vacuum of space is a really important feature of the system, because in the near vacuum of space, a feather and a rock travel along together because there's no air drag to cause the feather to slow up relative to the rock. This means that, for example, you could take very light objects in the shape of warheads and create decoys that would fool the system, since all it can do is look at the system, look at the decoys and the warheads, pretty much with not nearly the resolution that a human eye would have. And if you were in floating in space next to these objects, even in a spacesuit with your eyes, you couldn't tell a decoy from a warhead, because in the near vacuum of space, they would tumble the same way and they would travel along the same way. So the system is fundamentally flawed and has no chance of working in a real-world situation.
Can you talk about the document, Professor Postol, that you have disseminated that is the cause of the U.S. government, the Pentagon, going after you?
Well, what happened is in May of 2000, I wrote a letter to the White House basically outlining extensive scientific fraud in the National Missile Defense Program that was in part revealed by a document I obtained that had been released by the Department of Defense, not by me, in the process of putting together a False Claims Act lawsuit against a big defense contractor, TRW. And the document was originally a secret document where the elements of the document that were considered to be secret had been removed. But like many such documents, a large amount of the basic material was left in place, and a trained eye could easily tell what the contents were. And the document contained data from one of the first experiment in the missile defense program, the Integrated Flight Test 1A, and that data showed clearly that they would not be able to tell the difference between the decoys and the warheads. And I wrote President Clinton about this because it was clear that once this experiment had been done, all the other experiments in the flight program had been modified to not deal with this problem. So basically, they were planning to do 21 flight tests ending sometime in the year of 2005. The schedule has changed, as these schedules always do, but at that time, ending in the year of 2005, and they would have never tested against a modestly credible decoy. They would have avoided judiciously testing against these decoys. So it was basically rigged experiments, and the document itself, the data showed one thing, but the claims in the summary were completely uncorrelated with the data and the analysis in the document, hence scientific fraud.
Now, the Pentagon is asking MIT officials to stop you from disseminating the information and confiscate, and asking them, the MIT, to confiscate the document from you.
Yeah, I think basically a more accurate description is they're ordering or attempting to intimidate MIT into collecting these documents. And this is an unlawful act at many different levels. What has
the university president done?
Well, his initial reaction was to protect himself rather than the institution or the faculty. And that's a matter that he and I and other faculty are still planning to discuss. But now his later reaction has been to understand that this is an attack on the university itself, and in fact an attack on all universities. And so he is beginning to move in the direction of raising questions with the government. He's my own view is that his approach has been rather timid, inappropriately so in my view, especially given the illegal character of this attempt.
You're concerned that, or they are concerned that MIT will lose their contract to run the Lincoln Laboratory at Hanscom Air Force Base in Lexington, Mass?
Well, that's clearly their concern, that they'll lose this $300 million a year plus contract to run this laboratory. This, of course, is silly in my view, because Lincoln Laboratory needs MIT much more than MIT needs Lincoln Laboratory. Lincoln Laboratory staff people want to work for MIT, and in fact, that's a major reason why they are able to maintain such a high-quality staff there. So in fact, if the Department of Defense severed the ties, they would do far more damage to Lincoln Laboratory than they would to MIT. So this is an incredibly stupid thing for them to try to do under so many different circumstances that you could lay out, that in fact you can't find a sound argument, no matter how you try to construct one, why they would do something so stupid.
Now, a spokesperson for the military, for the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, argues that the department is obligated to stop you from disseminating potentially damaging information, even if it's already or even if it's readily available. Just because it's made public, it doesn't mean it's declassified.
Well, what he's basically saying is it's available to everybody else, but he wants to classify my intellect. Unacceptable. I suggest that this particular person in the Department of Defense read the Constitution of the United States. And, in fact, it might be a good idea, if this particular person thinks he's going to protect us from North Korea, that he not take actions that turn us into a country much like North Korea. So I don't think this is going to work, and I think these people have no basis for what they're trying to do.
Dr. Postol, you have an interesting history challenging the effectiveness of military weapons, going back to the 90s when you challenged the effectiveness of Patriot missiles in the Persian Gulf War, concluding that a report distorted the data and made it appear that the technology could reliably distinguish warheads from decoys. Do you think your job is safe at MIT?
Well, I think my job is as safe as MIT is. That is to say, I'm a senior member of the faculty with an international reputation for my work, and I think if MIT, if the administration were to do something inappropriate, not only would they find themselves in court for a breach of contract suit, but I think they would find themselves with an uprising of faculty, not only at MIT, but across the country. There's no legal basis for this activity. This is not, you know, I haven't been out doing something unlawful. This is essentially a heavy-handed attempt of government bureaucrats to basically, in one way or another, try to limit the ability of faculty at all of our research universities from analyzing and speaking about the results of their findings if the Pentagon doesn't like it. This is simply unlawful.
Dr. Postol, do you think you could lose your security clearance?
Well, may or may not happen. Frankly, I hold a security clearance in order to provide service to the country. I don't learn anything that's useful in my own work from a security clearance. I have learned pieces of information that are useful to the government, and I've been able to help the government understand things because I have certain intellectual capabilities or knowledge, and I'm happy to do that as a service to the country. If I serve the country best by not having a security clearance at this time, fine. There's no way they will ever take my security clearance forever because they have no cause for taking my security clearance forever. They can't show that I have done anything unlawful. They can't show that I have done anything improper.
Professor Postol, you now have turned to Congress to recruit support there. What can they do as you charge the Pentagon with a cover-up?
Well, I think the Congress can do quite a lot. I think the Pentagon needs to explain this behavior. In particular, General Kadish, who's head of the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, has been asked by Congressman Waxman of the Government Operations Committee to explain what's behind these amazing claims that that are being propagated by him and his organization. And I have the full expectation that he will not be able to in any way justify what he's been doing.
And this latest news that comes out of Defense Week magazine that reveals that the warhead that the National Missile Defense hit, that it was carrying a global positioning satellite beacon that made it easy to track, sort of like saying, come over here, here I am, here I am. Is this a big deal?
Well, not to me, to be honest with you. I think this, if the experiment were not fraudulent in terms of what people are claiming they achieved, that beacon doesn't mean much because they don't yet have radars up to the job of giving accurate tracking information to the kill vehicle, the interceptor. So I don't regard that as a particularly problematic feature of the experiment. What's problematic about the experiment is more profound, in fact. The experiment doesn't show anything other than guidance and control capable of hitting a cooperating target, which is a difficult thing to do, but is only the smallest part of the problem they need to solve to make a missile defense work in a combat environment. If, for example, the large balloon, they had two objects, a large balloon and a mock warhead, if the large balloon had failed to inflate, then the large balloon would look less bright than the warhead to the homing kill vehicle, and the homing kill vehicle would have homed on the less bright object because that's all it was told to do, and it would have homed on the canister of the balloon rather than the warhead. It has no ability, without predetermined information, to pick which object to home on, and that means any object that has even the smallest appearance of credibility as a warhead becomes a credible decoy. And they have no way of solving this problem. They have no technology in the future planned to address this problem. And so the system has no hope of working.
Well, Professor Postol, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a leading critic of the military's missile defense testing program. He says the Pentagon is trying to silence him as he tries to expose a Pentagon cover-up. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the story of a Hiroshima survivor on this 56th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Journalist David Lee writes in the Malaysian paper, the New Straits Times, at the point of detonation, half a kilometer up in the sky, the temperature shot to several million degrees centigrade. The mushroom atomic cloud reached an altitude of some 50,000 feet, a colossal tower of death taller than any building on Earth. The intense heat scorched bare skins and blinded eyes. Most people living within 1 kilometer of ground zero were killed instantly. Others were turned into zombies, many jumping into the rivers to douse the unbearable heat of fire on their bodies. The rivers were turned into watery graves. The blast that followed flattened houses and buildings and all standing structures. And then the black rain fell. The radioactive debris or fallout rained for an hour over a wide area. Those who were somewhat close to ground zero later suffered from after effects, including radiation-induced cancers. Today we're going to hear from a survivor of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima. 2 years ago, I went to New Mexico, and we broadcast Democracy Now! From the studios of KUNM on August 6th and August 9th of 1999, on the anniversaries of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we talked with survivors, both in New Mexico, Native Americans who had long been involved with the uranium cycle in New Mexico, where the atomic bomb was made at Los Alamos. And two women had come to New Mexico for major protests at Los Alamos labs around nuclear weapons. One who'd survived the Nagasaki bombing, and the other, Hibakusha from Hiroshima. Hibakusha means survivor of Hiroshima. Today we're going to hear her story. She is Sueko Motoyama, translated by Ria Nakamura.
生かされた一人の私が今日ここで
First, I want to thank to God that I survived through the atomic bomb.
まず
And have this opportunity to share my experience with all of you listening to this program. On that day, I was demolishing buildings to make fire breaks with other mobilized students about 1.5 kilometers away from the hypocenter. I was 12 years old then. In my first year of girls' junior high school, a strong flash pierced my eyes, and it turned all black with a roaring sound. I was blown away 15 meters by the blast. When I came to myself, I found my hair scorched and my clothes tattered, and the red flesh was showing with the skins on the surface hanging down from my hands and legs. I was wandered around crying for help aimlessly. There were dead bodies burned like burnt fish, here and there one on top of another. Those who were still alive stopped breathing, covered with blood all over. And there were a number of people who were not strong enough to utter a voice. I had to walk over dead bodies and the seriously injured, heading nowhere. When I passed by a river, I jumped into the river before I knew it. Because I felt my body was burning, it was so hot. More and more injured people got into the river from behind, and its surface was covered with countless injured and dead people. Many of them sank into the water when they died. I heard many of them were swallowing the water, and they went up and down the river with the tide several days. Two days after the bombing, A friend of mine in my neighborhood who had been missing in Hiroshima came home safe without any injury, so her family were very relieved, happy. However, she started to complain about her poor health about a month after and stayed in bed. Her hair fell out, and then blood came out of the nose, mouth, and ears, and she finally died of acute radiation symptoms in agony soon after. I had become too able to walk in those days, and the wounds healed it. But I also came to realize that something happened to my face. I found a mirror after searching everywhere in the house. I was astounded to see my face in the mirror, and I felt as if the ground was collapsing around me. I nearly lost the courage to live on. I can't express how I felt then with any words. Many survivors also experienced the similar desperation. I underwent 15 operations to try to have my scarred face restored.
Seiko Ikeda, a survivor of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima 54 years ago today, August 6th, 1945. After that day, Seiko Ikeda, you can translate right through the mic, that's okay. You can speak in Japanese, dear. What happened with your family, and do you continue to live in Hiroshima today?
Yes, I still live in Hiroshima. I used to live in the place 20 kilometers away from Hiroshima City. So other family members were not exposed to the radiation. I myself were exposed to the radiation.
Because
I commuted to the girls' school within the city of Hiroshima in those days.
How does it feel today to come to the area where the atomic bomb was made, that was dropped on Hiroshima?
原爆が製造されたこの広島の地に今来ていることについてどう思いますか？
How does it feel for you? How does it feel for you to be today in New Mexico?
New Mexico,
where the atomic bomb was built.
原爆が製造されたところに来ていることについて今どう思われますか？
For you to come here today, I understand you will go to Los Alamos.
ロスアラモスの国立研究所にも行かれると思うんですけど、どんな気持ちですか？
戦争の場に人間が立たされると狂気に変わってしまいます。
Well, I believe that the human beings turn into some devil when they are in the war.
そして人間が人間を殺すという大きな罪を犯すのです。
And they sometimes do the crimes to kill other human beings.
その生命を奪うのが戦争であり、核兵器なのです。
And that is the nature of war and the nuclear weapons, to take away other people's lives.
人間の手に、人間の知恵で作られたもので、人間が、人類が滅びていくような 核兵器は絶対この世にあってはならないと思います。
So I realized the really importance of the continue our appeal for the abolition of nuclear weapons because that will lead to the annihilation of human beings.
過去の憎しみを乗り越え、人類や国境の別なく増悪を。
We have to overcome the、hatred in the past, and also we have to united overcoming the boundaries of nations.
増悪。And that was a survivor of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima 56 years ago. I interviewed her 2 years ago in New Mexico, where Sueko Motoyama had come to, among other things, protest at the Los Alamos National Laboratories. But in addition to that, she came to throw hundreds of thousands of seeds, the Sister Nagasaki survivor, over the area where the atomic bombs were built to bring life to the area. And we're going to move now from Nagasaki, from Hiroshima, to the United States. The book, If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans, starts by saying that the supply of uranium that fueled the Cold War came largely from the Four Corners area of the United States. Some of the richest deposits were found on the Navajo Reservation. Between 1950 and 1980, as many as 15,000 people worked in uranium mines. About one quarter of the miners and millers were Native Americans. Responding to an urgent plea to help defend our country and eager to earn miners' wages, poverty-stricken Native Americans labored to feed the atomic mill. For nearly three decades, in the face of growing evidence that uranium mining was dangerous, state and federal agencies avoided responsibility for warning the miners or imposing safety measures in the mines. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of one of the women who worked as part of the economy of the uranium mines on a pueblo in New Mexico. But right now, we turn to Winona Hauter, Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environmental Program. She's just released a report called Another Nuclear Ripoff, Unmasking Private Fuel Storage. The report reveals that eight nuclear companies have teamed up to try to privatize for the first time the storage of high-level nuclear waste. Once again, the nuclear companies have their sites on Native American land. Winona Hauter, tell us where this is taking place.
Well, these big nuclear utilities that have tremendous inventories of waste and have established reputations for polluting and plundering and profiteering now want to take this waste to Utah and dump it on land belonging to the Skull Valley Band of Goshutes. And this corporate consortium has used very questionable tactics in forging a deal with the band. The chairman of the Goshutes approved the lease, but the band's general counsel has never even had a chance to vote on the agreement. And no one knows how much money the chairman has received. The documents, the lease agreement has been FOIA'd, or the Freedom of Information Act has been used to try to obtain that amount, and the amount is blacked out. So there are several lawsuits, and members of the band are even challenging the chairman's legitimacy in his role with the Goshutes.
The chair is?
His last name is Ray, and the band is very small. It only has about 130 members. And the idea would be that these utilities would be shipping casks of very high-level irradiated waste through 43 states and also exposing 50 million Americans on the way to Utah.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we will come back, and then we'll hear from Carletta Garcia, whose mother, Dorothy Purley, a well-known anti-nuclear activist herself involved with the uranium mines, recently died of cancer, and Carletta will tell her mother's story. We are talking to Winona Howder, who is Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environment Program. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Winona Howder, Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environment Program, can you name the companies that are pushing this site, this private fuel, nuclear fuel storage site in Utah?
Yes, some of the largest nuclear utilities in the country, Consolidated Edison, Southern California Edison, Southern Company, American Electric Power, GPU, the owner of Three Mile Island, Xcel, which the conglomerate includes Northern States Power, which also stores waste very close to a reservation, and Florida Power and Light.
And what are you encouraging people to do now?
Well, we're encouraging people to contact they're members of Congress. Right now, this dump is in the process of being licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're treating this as just a routine storage facility, as if it were the waste were being stored next to a nuclear power plant. We don't think the NRC should be making a decision of this magnitude. People should contact their member of Congress. And people who live in the service territories of these power plants, who own stock in them, should demand that the power companies get out of this outrageous scheme, because these utilities have acted more often than not as corporate criminals, and they're not responsible enough to be in charge of the nation's nuclear waste.
Is this the first time that there's been this attempt to privatize nuclear waste storage in the United States?
Well, this is an ongoing process. Many of these utilities have been involved over the years in trying to store waste on tribal land. This particular dump has come much farther than attempts in the past. For instance, there was an attempt to store waste on the Mescalera Indians' property, and the tribe voted it down.
And how does this relate to protests in Europe?
Well, I think that as this waste begins to move through states and on the nation's roads and rails, that we'll see the same types of protests. Now, there have been massive protests against waste moving from, for instance, France to Germany. We need to begin to create the same type of movement here to oppose the dangerous transportation scheme that moving this waste to Utah or to the dump that's proposed in Nevada. This waste is so dangerous that if a cask breaks open and someone's exposed to the radioactive material, that they will die in 3 minutes. And the casks used for transportation have only been tested with computer modeling, not physically tested. So this is a very irresponsible scheme to move waste to a temporary dump in Utah, where if it didn't become a permanent dump, it would have to be moved again.
And can you talk more about how this relates to Yucca Mountain, Nevada, where a permanent repository, the government is trying to place there, something that Native Americans and supporters have been trying to fight?
Yes. These utilities are trying to circumvent the public process in establishing a dump in Yucca Mountain. It's taking a long time. People in Nevada don't want the dump. The dump that's proposed is a terrible site. It's eventually going to leak. And so the utilities are trying to take things into their own hands by establishing this dump in Utah, especially now that they're trying to relicense old nuclear plants and even build new plants. They want to pretend there's a solution to the nation's waste problem.
Finally, when you look at private fuel storage, when you look at the large weapons company, and you look at this anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima 56 years later, what do you think is the answer to nuclear waste storage?
Well, the first thing we have to do is stop producing nuclear waste. And there isn't a really good solution for disposing of it in the long term. It needs to be kept from the environment and from the public, and we need to come up with a better option for dealing with this very dangerous waste that's going to be around for as long as 250,000 years. But producing more of it and taking it to unsafe dumps isn't a solution. It's just going to create more problems. So rather than focusing on creating new technologies to create energy from nuclear fission, we should have our scientific community trying to concentrate on coming up with a long-term solution for storing this toxic trash.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to get more information, where can they go?
www.citizen.org.
That's www.citizen.org. Thank you, Winona Hoder, Director of Public Citizens Energy and Environment Program. As we end with the story of Carletta Garcia, she's the daughter of Dorothy Perley, who was a well-known Native American uranium miner. 2 years ago, she attended Peace Actions Beyond the Bomb conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this is the story that she told about her family and the bomb.
My name is Carletta Garcia. I am a Native American from the Pueblo of Laguna. The Pueblo of Laguna is located 62 miles north of Albuquerque. There are 7 main villages on the Pueblo. The village where I was born is called Poati. I would like to start by mentioning again that I am the offspring of Dorothy Perley. Dorothy is a well-known and loved environmental activist and cancer survivor. Many of you who know Mom know how concerned about the future of our world is. Those of you who know Mom know that she's everybody's mom. I'm also mother to 2 wonderful children named Zachary and Spencer. Zachary is 16 and a junior in high school. Spencer is 8 and in the 3rd grade. I have been married for 18 years now to a wonderful man named Myron. Myron, who has been recently diagnosed with cancer, is now undergoing chemotherapy. He started yesterday. So as you can see, like my mother, I've also become quite concerned with the future. For 7 years now, my beautiful and loving mother has been dealing with cancer. She was diagnosed one early spring morning in January. As I remember, it was just a week before her 53rd birthday. A week prior to that, when she first told me about the lumps in her right breast, I tried to reassure her and myself that it was probably nothing to be alarmed at. But I knew that I was wrong when I saw the sadness in the doctor's eyes as he quietly came into the examination room after the biopsy. He told us that it was lymphoma. I cried until I could cry no more. I still cry. We were then sent down to the UNM Cancer Center, where Mother went through her first round of high-dose chemotherapy. Doctors prescribed dangerous and lethal drugs to kill off the cancer cells. They warned us that it would also kill off the good cells, too. Mom's main concern was never about herself. She worried about her children and her grandbabies. At the cancer center, they told us that she would have side effects from using the chemotherapy treatments. One of the side effects would be to lose her hair. The day came when Mom first lost her hair. My family and I planned to spend the weekend in Poati with her. She called me up on the phone that morning to tell me not to be alarmed because she was starting to lose her hair. As we approached her house, I could see her sitting outside on the picnic bench. She had a forced smile upon her face and a red scarf tied around her head. After the children hugged her and went inside, she called me and asked me if I was ready to see her hair. I said I was. When she untied her scarf, large clumps of her hair came off with it. When the breeze blew, strands of hair went flying. She looked like a half-plucked chicken. We both started to cry and fell into each other's arms. Then we began to laugh and laugh, for humor has always been a big part of our family. It is how we get through those rough times. Since then, Mom has been through chemotherapy on 3 different occasions. Even though she's a real fighter, she has become weaker and is more vulnerable to ailments. My mother, Dorothy, has lived almost all her life on the Laguna Reservation. The Laguna Reservation was once host to the world's largest open-pit uranium mine in North America. The mine is approximately 1,000 feet from the village of Powati, her home. It began its operation in about 1935 and was an economic boost for the poor people of the area. It was wartime, and the price of uranium had skyrocketed. But the people of Powati never knew that their own war was just beginning. As a child, my mother and I would often sit by the cliff, and she would tell me about how beautiful the valley of Powati was before the mining had began its operation. She told me of the orchards that once held peaches, pears, and apples. The gardens below our homes were green with corn, chili, and watermelon. She and her sisters would plant different types of flowers. The women of the village would then dry their fruits and vegetables in the sunshine. The people of the village would have plenty to eat during the cold season. I would sit at the edge of the cliff above the mine, close my eyes, and visualize how it used to look. But when I would open my eyes, all I could see was ugly, gray, and barren, the land before me. In the summer afternoons, my cousins and I would listen for the siren that announced the explosions that happened every day at noon and at 4:30. We'd sit and watch the blast of dynamite loosen the uranium from the earth. A big puff of dust, rock, and soil would billow up into the sky. We could hear the rocks fall back down to the earth. The blast was so intense that it would sometimes shake glasses off the cabinets in the kitchen. If the wind was just right, it would push the foul-smelling dust toward the village. We would pretend that it was a big monster trying to get us and race back into the house to eat our lunch. Little did we know that it was really a monster, one that would chase us for the rest of our lives. As years went by, my mother and other females were introduced into the workforce at the mines. Dorothy worked as a truck driver and hauled high-grade uranium ore to the crusher to be milled and taken back to the mill site near Grants. It was carried by train cars through other nearby villages, including Acoma, where my husband's family lived, into the town of Grants. She also directed the large trucks to dump their loads of uranium ore onto stockpiles for later shipment. Yes, life was good economically in those days. The Pueblo of Laguna was considered to be among the wealthiest tribes and was given honors for being self-supportive. The high school students would plan to work at the mine immediately upon completion of high school. In those days, working at the mine would give you a high-paying job without a degree. Unfortunately for the Lagunas, or should I say fortunately, around the early 1980s, the price of uranium plummeted. We were in peacetime by then, and the people who were employed by the uranium mine were terminated. Around that time, I was also employed at the mine and worked at the repair shop. I serviced trucks that were contaminated with radiation dust particles. The other employees and I ate lunch while sitting alongside the stockpiles of uranium. We were never told about the hazards of radiation. I do not ever recall ever hearing about radiation at all. When the mining operation shut down, things were quite a disaster. People were filing for bankruptcy. Automobiles and mobile homes were repossessed. Everyone was looking for a job, and the graduates did not plan for the future were in a bind. Worst of all was the land. It was mutilated and left like an open sore to fester. The winds blew the contaminated stockpiles for miles, and the rains washed the radiation into runoffs in nearby streams. Our homes were also damaged by the years of dynamite blasting and were in disrepair. Then the people began to become ill. For years now, cancer seems to be a growing epidemic among our people. It seems that every death in our area is related to cancer. People that Mother and I worked with are dying left and right. The tribal government of the Pueblo of Laguna still denies that we have a problem in our hands. My mother and a few of her close friends have formed an organization called the Laguna Acoma Coalition for a Better Environment. This little group is determined to help other tribes and people understand the importance of becoming aware of the dangers of radiation contamination. They have taken surveys in the Puati area and have helped to identify the problems of health, which seem to be specifically related to radiation from the mine. There are many other problems that plague the people of Puati. There is a high rate of miscarriages and stillbirths, mental retardation and physical abnormalities. My mother always tells me that she will fight as long as she is able. On days that she becomes tired, I remind her that she is still needed badly by others. She is needed to educate others by example. I do not know how much longer that I will get to be with her. I hope it is a long, long time. Mother sends her love in regards to everyone. She is in New England as we speak, attending another convention along with other nuclear survivors. In closing, I want to say, let us listen and learn by Mother and others like her. Our elders are so wise and wonderful. We also have future generations to worry about. Always remember our Mother Earth. If we destroy her, we destroy ourselves. If we destroy her, we destroy ourselves. May the Great Spirit bless you and your loved ones. Thank you.
Carletta Garcia speaking 2 years ago at the Beyond the Bomb Conference of Peace Action in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She is the daughter of the late Dorothy Perley, who died soon after that speech, a well-known Native American uranium miner.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way. To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people. To those who left their communities by force or by choice and through generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find. To those that turn away the so-called...
And you are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we've been told to acknowledge those who make Democracy Now! Possible. Corporation for Public Broadcasting helps to fund Pacifica Radio and the five Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI in New York, as well as the Pacifica affiliates. And, of course, you, the listeners, we are Pacifica. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, and our music maestro, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Innocent or guilty,
to the young, the old, the living, and the dead,
to our brothers and sisters.